among young children. Suzanne appeared on Bread and Roses way back in 2006 for a couple of fun and educational shows. We did a show on Little Mean Girls, social aggression among preschool girls. And we also talked about The Power of the Princess, an examination of the impact of the princess icon across generations of girls. Since that time, Suzanne has continued her research and earned a doctorate degree from the University of Texas at Austin. She is here tonight to share practical strategies and findings from her recent research on understanding the excluder, why young children exclude their peers. We'll discuss the reasons why young children use exclusion to accomplish their social goals, the importance of teaching key social skills, and how adults can help children navigate difficult social situations and develop healthy relationships. Dr. Suzanne Fanger made a special trip up here to Portland from the Bay Area to be with us tonight. Welcome back, Suzanne Fanger.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, Suzanne, what compelled you to do this work?
Well, for a long time, I was a preschool teacher, and I saw how extremely important it was for young children to be developing good social skills, and how preschool was really the only time when educators had the freedom and the leeway to actually help kids directly with their social skills. By the time kids get to kindergarten, there is so much curriculum that is mandated and that teachers really feel is important for children to cover that there's very little time left, most teachers believe, in their schedule to think about social things. And in fact, by about around the age of five, many social patterns get set for children. So a child who becomes a victim and is a victim at the age of five is, well, not for sure, likely that they may still be a victim at the age of 12. And so early childhood is such an important time to be thinking about social education for young children.
And why is it important to understand and address exclusion among young children?
Well, exclusion, it turns out, the more I got interested in social education, the more I realized that exclusion was pervasive. As a teacher, I started noticing exclusion all the time. And when I did my research, found that it is extremely common and normative. We were actually witnessing one incident of exclusion every 7 minutes when we were doing observational research. So it's happening all the time. And it happens for a variety of reasons. We'll talk about those tonight. That are extremely normal and are very logical. They're really, exclusion is used to solve a lot of social problems. But the problem is that exclusion can be really harmful for kids, and children who are excluded can feel awful from it. So we have this conundrum of a behavior that is normative, normal for children to engage in, but yet can cause a lot of harm. And so it's so important that we start thinking about how as adults we handle it. And many adults don't really know what to do when they see young children excluding.
This discussion tonight is going to center around your recent research. It seems relevant to talk about the study group that you used for this research.
So I was doing some research as a part of my graduate work in Texas. A lot of my sample, a lot of the children I was looking at were white, upper middle class. They came from very well-educated families. So it's important for us to realize that we're using that lens when we talk about exclusion. There's a lot of other people's research that points to how conflict is handled differently by different groups. So it's important to realize that what we're talking about is white, upper middle class American ways of looking at conflict, which exclusion is kind of a part of conflict. So I think of that. For example, Lynn Michael Brown did some work where she looked at a group of older girls, but she was looking at upper middle class girls and then working class girls, and noticed that the working class girls were much more direct and confrontational in the way they handled conflict than the upper middle class girls, who tended to be more subtle. They tended to avoid conflict. Conflicts, as a result, lasted longer with them. So you can see from that example that the way things are handled in one group might not necessarily reflect all groups. So when we're thinking about why kids exclude and what's happening with early childhood classrooms and exclusion. Ours here, we're talking mostly about white and middle class.
So that's considered, you know, the dominant culture in this country. So if even if you're not in that group, you're going to bump up against that group pretty soon. So yeah. It's important to understand where they're coming from.
Yes. And I've found that because of that, you know, if you know, one thing that happens in our culture is that the majority of educators come from that same background. And so they're going to look at conflict from that same lens. You know, conflict is generally seen from a white upper middle class lens in a lot of school settings. And of course, not in all. But that's going to give you a different way of looking at conflict if you, for example, are an upper middle class teacher teaching a bunch of working class kids who handle conflict very differently.
Right. They might label or, you know, have issues with other cultural groups that are more direct. Like, there was an interesting example in your thesis of an Italian preschool, and that those kids were just much more at ease with kind of the boisterous big group negotiations and conversations that happen around solving problems in a large group. Whereas, you know, middle class white kids were like taught to, you know, be polite, and, you know, they were less comfortable with just hashing things out and getting things resolved. You know, that's why they kind of went underground and were a little more manipulative, perhaps, in their dealings.
The Cursero's work showed the Italian children, they really loved, an important part of their play were group debates and discussions. And when he looked at the American kids, he saw a lot less of this large group debate and discussion. The Italian kids even had a name for it, where they would come in and they would sort of have these sort of sing-song arguments that were almost formulaic, where they would just argue for the fun of it almost. And I can't picture very many American kids that would, you know, engage in that on a regular basis.
It's like not our comfort zone.
No.
And we get really uncomfortable and can come out in other ways that are harder to spot and harder to address. So I think it's very relevant to mention your study group and then begin. It made me think a lot about how other cultures would, you know, be potentially harmed.
Yes. Having a different way of looking at it.
Yes. One message that from your research that was very clear was that there were many different motivating factors for the reasons why children are excluding. So can you talk about some of the key ones that you...
Sure. So a lot of what I was doing with my research was I was looking at children who are playing, and they're playing out on the playground, and we were looking for every time they excluded each other. And then, you know, we were recording as much information as we could on it. And after doing that, I looked at all of these exclusion incidents, and I had, you know, well over 100 of them, and tried to understand what was causing the exclusion. You know, what happened beforehand? What happened after? What were the relationships involved? What were the children like? To try and figure out why that exclusion was happening. So there were quite a few, of course, reasons that this happened. And of course, many times children were excluding for multiple reasons. But one that stands out for me was that children often excluded in order to feel powerful or in order to be in control. You know, and by that I mean that children want to be powerful. They want to make decisions in their life. They want to feel in control. And so the children were using exclusion as a way to be powerful in their games, to be leaders of their games, to control the games. So they were using power and control to exclude.
Yeah, you pointed out that it might be because children are largely powerless in the adult world. And so they grapple for power and control. They experiment with it, and they go for they it's really key for them. It's a central theme in their interactions when they're among their peers.
Yeah, especially amongst young children. I mean, if you think about how young children are when they're outside of a school environment, most of their decisions are made by a grown-up. You know, they don't have a lot of choice in what they do from day to day. And so when they're in a group with peers, this is their opportunity to be the leaders, to be the boss, to be the ones who are making the decisions. And if you are in a position where you can do that, exclusion is a great way to be powerful. It's a great way to control your peers. And it really helps a young child who might have been feeling powerless to feel powerful. You know, when you exclude someone, there's probably a great rush of power that comes to you.
No doubt.
And power and status, I think, are really important for all humans. I mean, it's, you know, we all want to feel in control of our lives. We all want to be able to make decisions. So I think it's very natural that everybody want to have power. And young children, because of this powerlessness, they do bring it up in their play a lot. It's a central theme of their play. They play about being powerful characters a lot. And so anything that gives them an opportunity to feel powerful is likely to get repeated and done a lot. So exclusion.
So how would that play out? Can you give us an example of that?
Yeah, sure. Well, a child who is trying to take a lead in a game might turn down newcomers, and then therefore it sort of demonstrates that they're the leader of the game. So they can say, nope, there's no room for you, or you can't play, or you can be the helper. You know, give them some sort of marginal, nominal role in the game to show that they are in control. You know, and that makes them feel very powerful. I think one of the things that I noticed, though, is that there were a lot of children who occasionally seemed to want power, but there were a few children who seemed to have a really deep need for power, who seemed to have a very different relationship with power, where they were seeking control of themselves, of their play environments, of their activities, of other children, of a play space, of the toys. They were seeking control and power all the time. And I think that that is a very different sort of way of using power than the kids who just occasionally wanted to be powerful because it feels good to be powerful and it feels good to be in control.
What was motivating those kids that were a little heady with power?
Well, I can't know for sure. I have suspicions that it has something to do with what's going on outside of school. And over the years of watching, I feel like every year or so I would encounter a child like that who had a really deep need for power. And after observing them over years, I suspect that it's because they either have too much or too little power at home. There's no research on this. But often that child might be the boss of the family too, even though they were only four, and might be making adult-sized decisions at home, or they might have very little power at home. We had one girl who often sought power in our study, and it turned out, I learned from one of her teachers, that she was the youngest of a group of siblings who weren't super nice to her all the time. You know, they kind of bossed her around. So I think she was kind of powerless at home. Mm-hmm. And when she came to school, that was her place where she got to be powerful, finally. She got her chance to be the one who made the decisions. So I suspect either too much or too little power.
So as a teacher or a parent, how can you help children to, you know, find balance in terms of their need to express power, but not to let it get overdone?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I mean, there's a number of pieces there, and I think one of them is giving kids opportunities to feel powerful. I mean, everybody needs to be in charge of some things sometimes and feel good about that. But I think when you use the word balance, I think that's really a key factor. And that is something that I think about all the time when I'm with children and when I'm teaching people about children, is trying to help them develop a balance of skills. So we don't want anyone to have too much power, but we want them to have some power. So we want children to learn to lead and control and know how to do that, but we don't want them to have to do it all the time. So we want children to become leaders, but we also want them to learn how to be followers too. So we want them to develop a balance of both leading and following skills. And so when I often notice that most children might have a natural tendency to head one way or the other. So any adult who spends a lot of time with a child might want to notice, are they naturally a leader, naturally a follower? And if so, how can I help them learn the other side? How can I help a leader learn to be a good follower, learn to take direction from someone else, learn to see that it's okay to let someone else decide what game to play sometimes? And I think another piece of that I think a lot about is that children are not going to develop this balance of being a leader and a follower, of being powerful but not too powerful, unless they are forming friendships where the power within the relationship is balanced. So a really powerful kid, an overly powerful kid, is probably going to want to be friends with children who are a lot less powerful. Because boy, is it easy. They're going to do whatever I ask. But is that going to serve them well? Not so much. So we want to find a powerful kid to be friends with a powerful kid, because they're going to balance each other out. And if everybody wants to lead, at some point you're going to have to take a turn following. So I try to help children develop relationships where the power is balanced, where two children who might naturally gravitate to following have to learn to play together. And they're going to have to learn to both lead if they're going to, you know, successfully play.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. Our guest tonight is Dr. Suzanne Fanger. She studies peer interactions among young preschool age young children and develops socio-emotional curriculum and strategies for parents and educators to help children develop social skills and form healthy relationships. We're talking about some of the reasons why children use exclusion, and we're talking about strategies throughout, but we'll get to a lot of the strategies later in the show. But I would love if you could talk about another reason why children use exclusion. It seemed like a lot of instances of exclusion occurred around relationships, group identity, and friendships. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, friendships are a reason for exclusion. When children are playing together and they're playing with someone that they consider a friend, they might decide to exclude someone in order to protect that friendship. So one unique thing to keep in mind about young children is that for young children, friendship is defined by who you are with at the moment. Friendships are very transitory and in the moment, because young children in general live very much in the moment. So a young child might not even think about that person they played with last week as a friend because they're not playing with them right now. So exclusion comes into this, because if you're playing with your friend and somebody else wants to come join the game, well, wait a minute. Is your friend still your friend if there's someone else there? And if your friend leaves the game, they're definitely not your friend anymore. So if you are successfully playing with a friend, you're going to do everything you can to protect that game. If another person joins, that friendship itself is called into question.
That was really surprising to me in that research. I knew friendships were important to young children, but I didn't understand that they're synonymous with play. Like, the play is what defines that friendship. And if you stop playing with a friend, you perceive that as the relationship is over.
Yeah,
that was really interesting to know.
It puts a unique emphasis on things succeeding.
Yeah.
And I think that for this reason, I tend to emphasize for young children that it's important that they have lots of different friends. And I'll talk about friends even when they're not currently, you know, a friend is someone that you may not be playing with them right now, but that person is your friend and that person is your friend as well, because you have something in common and you've enjoyed each other before. And one thing that I think, unfortunately, as children get older, they tend to focus on is having a best friend. Mm-hmm. And I think that best friends can actually itself be an exclusionary construct. It implies exclusion just in the idea of having a best friend. And so I think it's much more important to emphasize that kids have a lot of different friends and not just a best friend, because then there's less need to be exclusionary about your friendship.
Mm-hmm. And how can parents model healthy friendships?
Well, I think that modeling is really important for adults. I think that if adults can show children a model of a healthy relationship, if adults can show children how they have themselves have a lot of different friends that they do different activities with, or that they all trust all of them and know that they're all friends, then children are going to start to pick up on that. A parent who's highly isolated or has only one friend is going to send a very different message to the children.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so group dynamics, how does that fit into this?
Well, I think exclusion is often used to establish group identity. So that's kind of a whole nother interesting piece of exclusion that I found when I was looking at what the young children were doing, was that children were using exclusion to define their social groups. And if I think about this, it was a little bit surprising to see it happening in young children. But if I think about sort of middle school popular cliques, it really gives me a vivid picture of the exclusiveness of a popular clique and how the membership in a popular clique is used to define the group itself. And so exclusion is a part of being a part of a group. You have to define who's a part of the group and who's not a part of the group. And young children use that too.
Huh. You know, and it's interesting because when you talk about groups, there's this evolutionary aspect, you know. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, evolution, so humans are a group living species. I really think that keeping in mind evolutionary goals and survival goals is always really interesting when looking at human behavior and psychology, because there are a lot of ways that evolution can subtly influence, you know, maybe why all humans tend to do this thing or that thing. And I think exclusion is one of those. If we as humans are a group living species, and which means, and that is what evolutionary psychologists have decided is most likely, we have evolved in order to survive in groups. So we need those groups in order to be evolutionarily successful in order to pass on our genes. It's about how we function as a group to get our needs met. So we have to define those groups if we're gonna successfully survive. And
so there's this imperative behind a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
That kids probably don't even.
No, they don't. They, of course, don't have any
idea. Many
adults
don't either.
But groups are, if we're all gonna survive in a group, each group member has to be a good, successful, contributing group member. So we have to make decisions about inclusion or exclusion in order to make our group successful. While today we're not really trying to survive in order to decide our groups, there is a piece of that that I think comes with it. And young kids, even when they're just deciding who's gonna play, are having to make decisions about inclusion and exclusion. Who's going to be a good group member? Who's going to contribute to the play? Who do I want to trust to be a part of my in-group, my friend group? And so exclusion is commonly used to define those groups.
And so it seems like the trick is to teach children what, you know, it can run amok. If, you know, you, in a way, you have to give children a sense of what makes a good group and what sort of exclusion is just not cool. You know, you talk a lot about there's a bystander often in an act of exclusion. If one child's excluding another, often a peer standing right there watching it happen. And as part of the group dynamic, you mentioned that it's important to work with the bystander to empower them to know how to react when they see exclusion happening in a group set situation, instead of just being the silent observer.
Which is really hard, because going along with exclusion is very much often a part of group identity. So if a group is going to define themselves by excluding some other people who aren't a part of the group, then all the members of the group are going to kind of get brought into that exclusion, be part of the exclusion, because they're part of deciding who's in their group. You know, and in an ideal world, we would be teaching young children that being a passive bystander when you see something going wrong isn't ideal. It's not okay. And that we all have a responsibility to stand up for it. That's a really hard thing to talk to young children about. Yeah. But yeah. I think that we can give children another focus for their groups that's not just about exclusion. One thing that I did find that happened was that children would use exclusion as sort of the sole activity of their group. They would form a group of children that didn't necessarily have anything in common or anything to play about. And so it was all about being exclusive. So that we're going to play over here in this lonely place all by ourselves and nobody else can play with us. Gives you something in common with the other people you're in that lonely place with, but doesn't really move you on to actually successfully playing.
You point out in your thesis that there are strategies, you know, since groups are part of human nature and they can be wonderful, but a lot of icky stuff occurs around those boundaries of groups. You point out that teachers and parents can, you know, work with that group setting, but create a more bonding, shared experience among a large group. Mm-hmm. So they have practice instead of just holding up in one corner of the playground. There's actually something that reinforces the positivity of a functioning group of...
Can give them a group activity, ideally one that's an inclusionary in case anybody else wants to play, that can help them feel like a team, accomplishing a goal, for example, you know, building a house to play in, but that gives a focus for the activity that's not merely exclusion.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. Our guest tonight is Dr. Suzanne Fanger. She's here talking about some reasons why young children use exclusion to accomplish social goals. And she'll be sharing even more strategies for parents and educators on how to address and help children develop social skills around this issue. We're going to take a very quick musical break and we'll be back with more solutions. That was The Wings by Gustavo Santaolalla from the Brokeback Mountain soundtrack. You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Leanne Kranz. I'm in the studio tonight with Dr. Suzanne Fanger, returning to Bread and Roses to share her expertise on the socio-emotional education of young children. We're talking about her latest research tonight, Understanding the Excluder, Why Young Children Exclude Their Peers. We've been talking about some of these reasons children exclude for power and control and to establish group identity and friendships. What are some other key reasons why children use exclusion to accomplish their own social goals?
Well, children exclude quite frequently in order to protect their play. Play is really important to young children for a variety of reasons, but it's really difficult for them, particularly for preschoolers. They really work so very hard to sustain play, but it's a lot of work, especially when you're talking about pretend play, you know, where kids are trying to take on roles and they're trying to negotiate and they're trying to pretend about some really sophisticated things. This is hard work for them, right? Because they're having to work at a very high level socially. They're having to keep other people's agendas in mind. They're having to manage their own emotions. It's challenging. And one of the problems that makes it even more challenging is interruptions. Young children have a difficult time with interruptions. Adults can really easily, if I get interrupted in a conversation, chances are, you know, by the phone ringing or a dog barking, chances are I'm going to be able to go back and finish that conversation a couple minutes later. Mm-hmm. Not so much for preschoolers. Once they get interrupted, it's really hard to get back. And if you think about when you're pretending to be, I don't know, a dog, and somebody asks you a question about your shoes, suddenly you're not a dog anymore. Yeah. And it's going to take you a minute to like figure out how to be a dog again. So children will exclude in order to protect their play because every interruption means an interruption to play. Every child that tries to join the play is interrupting that play. And the more children playing, the harder it is to sustain. You know, it's like playing tennis with four people instead of with two people, where you have to be hitting the ball to all of the other three people constantly instead of just to one other person. It gets vastly more complicated. So exclusion can solve that problem. It can help you be successful in your play if you just don't let it get interrupt you. And if you just don't let anyone else in, you're way more likely to play successfully. They work so hard to play.
And they get interrupted so frequently. You know, as an adult now, I'm thinking about that a little differently. Your research, again, going back to what we talked about a little earlier in the show, that play is so much more than we might remember it. It has so much bearing on how they define their friendships. And it's, as you mentioned, their linguistic and cognitive skills are such that actually launching a game takes, you know, great effort.
A tremendous amount of work. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there are also outside interruptions. You know, there's constantly, play is so precious. And, you know, even in the study group we had, the children had an hour outdoors every day. Mm-hmm. But by the time they actually got out there and got their game started, it was really only 50 minutes. And about 10 minutes before the kids had to go back inside, the teacher would often ask them to check in about bathroom breaks and getting drinks and getting the sand out of their shoes. Okay, so now you've got a 40-minute play period. And then you have that again when a teacher comes and asks you if you want to plant a flower or, you know, it gives you some other fun opportunity, but hey, that's stepping into the middle of your game. So I think that children really need long periods of uninterrupted play, and that the fewer things that break up that play period, the more successful they're going to be, and also the less they're going to worry about exclusion.
Yeah,
about
less stress around that situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would cause exclusion.
Yes, exactly.
Interesting. I was really interested in that idea that the environment can be a big factor in whether or not exclusion happens. Can you talk about that a little bit, the context?
Sure. I mean, I think we were talking about kind of how schedule might impact it, and also the actual environment that we create for kids can really impact how they interact socially. I think you and I were talking before about an example of a small playhouse. Which is a really important thing for young children to have small enclosed places to play in. But it becomes a site of negotiation for exclusion because you only have room for so many kids and it tends to be kind of owned by whoever gets there first. And so it's going to be a site of a lot of exclusion. And if you're an adult looking to see if there's exclusion going on, those are key places to keep an eye out, because it's likely that in such a small space, if someone new tries to come in, some of them might get accepted, but a lot of them are going to get excluded. The same thing is also true for materials. You know, if we have a limited number of materials, if you have four kids who want to play and only three shovels, guess what's going to happen? Exclusion is likely. And you can hear in what I'm saying that a lot of this environment that I'm thinking about is the outside play space. I actually did all of my research outdoors on a playground because I find that children's conflicts tend to happen mostly out there. You know, inside classrooms is so much more of a controlled environment. Mm-hmm. Teachers are a lot closer by physically. There tend to be more scheduled activities. You know, there's an art project. There's Play-Doh on a table. So there's more defined parameters for children's interactions. Whereas when you're outside on the playground, you can be a lot further from the adults and they can't hear what you're saying. And you're given a lot more free rein to mm-hmm. make your own choices, which is wonderful and key and so important for children because that's where pretend play is happening, which is, you know, the highest expression of play. But it also means that the playground is the place that exclusion and conflict happens. And as teachers, we should be really looking at that. And as adults, any adult who is around children who are out in free play, playing somewhere where the kids are making their own choices, we need to be looking at and seeing what's really going on with those kids. Is there something under the surface that we're not noticing, like exclusion or conflict?
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I have to say that the most surprising piece of this research has to be that sometimes exclusion is not the fault of the excluder. Do you mind elaborating on that?
Sure. You know, at the beginning, I mentioned that exclusion is highly normative. There are a lot of really good reasons that it occurs, you know, and that means that exclusion is not something negative or something bad that kids do. And kind of highlighting that even more, a lot of times the exclusion happens because of something that child who's getting excluded did. And it means that the exclusion is perfectly reasonable. So, for example, a child who has kind of terrible social skills, frankly, and who is annoying. We had one child in our study who would just kind of shout the same thing over and over again and didn't really move on from it. And she would, for example, just meow loudly over and over and over right in another child's ear and maybe kind of whack that child on the head to get their attention. Well, yeah, sure, they're probably going to get excluded because that's a difficult thing to be around, someone who's whacking on the head and yelling meow constantly. So I felt like a lot of the exclusion was due to the excludees, the child who was being excluded's behavior. And which meant that I felt like the excluder's behavior was pretty justified. I think that we have a tendency to dichotomize kids into good and bad, and that the excluder would often be the mean kid, the kid who is not letting anyone play, who is trying to be a bully, who is keeping other people out. But I have a great deal of empathy for the excluders, because sometimes they're just trying to protect their play, or they're just trying to have a friend, or that they're just trying not to get bugged by somebody really annoying.
Yeah, you know, I have to say, when I started reading this research, I came to it with my own set of prejudgments. I just assumed the excluder was always the bad one, and the victim was always the one that the teacher or parent should rush to comfort and support. But you point out that the excluder, in some cases, is the one who needs to be supported in that. Because what happens if you don't? If you never side with the excluder?
Well, I think a few things happen. And one is that, you know, the excluder might start to kind of take on that role of being the bad kid. If we're always assuming that they're right, the bad kid, and they're making bad choices, they're going to realize that in order to protect themselves, they have to be the mean girl. They have to do that. And I think that our culture has a tendency to dichotomize kids' behavior. And mean girls is such a common trope. There are so many books about mean girls, mm-hmm. and so many movies, and almost every children's book, even ones that are all about, you know, empowerment for girls, have a mean girl character in them. And I think that in the real world, those mean girls are often girls who wanted to assert themselves or who wanted to take care of themselves and maybe get a little bit labeled and decide that they have to stick with that label if they're not just going to be nicey nice and let everyone walk all over them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can get into some dangerous territory if a girl gets labeled as bad for simply protecting herself or sticking up for herself.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, it's important to say that I don't think this means that we should just let kids exclude, though, because it still has these harmful consequences. So I think it's really important for adults to be more actively involved in those circumstances. For example, that kid who's being excluded because they don't have, for example, the social skills or they act younger than their peers, they do need a lot of help. They need a lot of adult support to learn more effective social skills so that they can play and they can have friends. But we also can't just say no exclusion and leave it at that, because then those children who are excluding, really, they need some protection from us as well. So one thing that I would do would be to sort of almost join a game in a very minor role so that I could make sure that the game didn't get interrupted, didn't get ruined by that less skilled player's entrance into the game. Mm-hmm. So I might, you know, kind of just quietly whisper to the less skilled child some ideas for the game, or help them to sort of pay attention to what was happening in the game so that those children wouldn't have to exclude, they wouldn't need to exclude that kid in order to protect their play.
Yeah, it seems very clear from your research that it's not black and white. You parents and teachers really have to, as you say, be engaged and aware. And as you say, it's really important, because these patterns get set by the time a child is five. Not only are, you know, it seems that the research shows so many things are set by then, and if we don't, you know, address the stuff in a very thoughtful way early, that kids can get pigeonholed or damaged very young.
And that's why I started doing this work and got really interested in this, because I think that anyone who works with children or wants to help children needs to come to a deeper understanding of what's going on. When you have something happening constantly on the playground, like exclusion, you have to really be able to pay attention to what's happening and understand it, you know, understand what are all the different possible reasons that a kid might exclude, so that when I see it happening, I can say, oh, it's that child who's really seeks a lot of power, or, oh, of course it makes sense because the person trying to get into the game has not very many social skills, and so they're difficult to play with. I'm going to have to support that play in a very different way. I'm going to have to help those children in very different ways, depending on the reason that the exclusion occurred.
And another surprising piece of this study was that rarely is the motivation simply to harm another child, that there are all those other reasons we've talked about that sometimes are rooted in our human evolution, you know, the deep-seated reasons, and they come from all different angles. So, again, it's really, it's not as simple as you might
think.
And
I've started thinking about, when I discovered this for younger children, I started thinking about this for older children, even thinking about that quintessential older kid bully. And when you think about really what might be a motivation behind that action, it's not necessarily to harm. You think about the lunch money stealing or the beating up kid. They're probably trying to be powerful. They're probably trying to consolidate their power or show that they are important. And sure, they're hurting someone terribly.
They need support too.
But they need support too in a very different way.
Exactly. We're speaking with Dr. Suzanne Fanger, talking about the many reasons why young children use peer exclusion to accomplish their particular social goals. In the last 10 minutes, Suzanne, can you please talk about what are the key social skills that we should be helping our youngest children develop, and any strategies or advice that you have for parents and teachers to avoid exclusion run amok?
Sure. So social skills, first of all. I mean, there are so many things that children learn as they're getting older, but a few of them are, when you really watch children play and you study the research on children's play and play entry, it's a lot different than we as adults might think. For example, never, ever ask if you can play. That is one of the least effective strategies. And I hear many, many parents and teachers suggest, well, just go ask if you can play.
Yeah.
Well, problem is 90% of the time, you are going to get turned down. And the only children who actually use that strategy tend to be less powerful kids asking more powerful kids. So it's really easy to say no to them. So instead of asking, can I play, an effective player will observe a game that's happening, and they will try and learn to understand what that game is, you know, figure out what the kids are playing, and then they'll try and figure out what a role for themselves might be. And then when they figure that out, and adults can, of course, help with that at first, when they figure that out, then they will enter with either a statement of their role or some sort of contribution to the game. So, for example, if you're watching a bunch of kids who are having a bakery store, you're going to learn what they're playing, and you might either enter with a pan full of cupcakes to help them sell, or maybe you would enter with a statement, I want to buy some. Mm. And those would be much more effective.
So blend. Learn to blend.
Yeah, learn to
take
blend
a minute
and
to
enter
observe.
Slowly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's good advice for adults as well.
Yes. I think so too. And if one strategy fails, try another more subtle one. Also good for adults. But because a lot of the times, the first time you try and enter, it's not necessarily going to go well. You know, if you're at a cocktail party and you're trying to get into a group conversation and you're not really sure about it and you kind of stand on the edge for a while, maybe somebody won't pay attention to you and you'll have to come up with another strategy like, mm-hmm. oh, that happened to my brother too.
Right.
You know, or some way to enter. So we as adults have to think about that. Let's see, other important social skills.
I love the be able to teach children how to read social cues and reactions.
Yeah.
So many adults even have difficulty.
Yes. So. Yes. Some of these are kind of the reasons where I imagine that someday there will be a preschool for grown-ups who can go back and get a refresher course on some of these skills.
It's clear we're not learning them, though, as children, you know? We don't learn them. And
yeah.
It causes so many issues with our own relationships and with different cultural groups, etc.
One thing that we haven't talked a lot about that I think is at the heart of all this is comfort with conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a really key social skill.
Mm-hmm.
I really like to work with children a lot around having conflicts. And frankly, the more conflicts, the better. Because the more you practice any skill, the better you're going to get at it. And if you have an adult who is standing by to give a little bit of guidance when necessary to ensure that the conflict is solved in a fair manner and in a way that is comfortable and works for all parties involved, mm-hmm. then you're going to start to learn not only are conflicts not a big deal, but I'm capable of solving them. And once kids get to kindergarten and they're on the playground, there is nobody there to help them solve a conflict. So every child needs to go to kindergarten with the ability to solve a conflict independently.
I still don't know how to solve conflicts. I mean, we pointed out at the beginning of the show, you know, this research centered around white middle class kids who aren't taught, they're taught that conflict is bad and you run from it, you
yeah.
know, and it's just,
yeah. Well,
and then when we do have conflict, it's way overblown, you know, mm-hmm. and often it ends the relationship.
We're often taught to walk away. And I think there's a gender piece for that in parts of American culture. I think that some white upper middle class girls are taught less about conflict even than other groups. There's a discomfort with girls' anger still in some mm-hmm. places. There is a tendency to teach them to think about other people's feelings instead of making sure that their own agendas are met as well. And so sometimes kids don't feel comfortable with those skills. And so they will walk away from or avoid it instead mm-hmm. of just talking through a problem. And exclusion, actually, some people think that exclusion is a way to avoid conflict, right? If you can just keep mm-hmm. someone out of the game, you don't have to have a confrontation with them.
They're getting a lot of mixed messages, it sounds like, currently.
Yes.
So in the last 5 minutes, Suzanne, can you give some teachers and parents some real specific strategies that they can begin to think about in their dealings with children?
Sure. I think, I think one thing that I really wanted to touch on that I think is really important is to be able to get a sense, and this is going to come from observing kids and understanding where they are. And I think we do have to look at, you know, any parent should spend some time watching their child in social interaction with a group and with individual friends so that they can understand where their child fits into the social strata. I think it's always really important to know who's powerful and who's not powerful, whose ideas get done, whose ideas don't get done. And it's really hard to help your child to develop those balance skills that we were talking about, to learn to be a leader and a follower, if you don't really know where they sit on that spectrum. Mm-hmm. So I think that parents and teachers as well really need to observe and learn about their child's social behavior and realize that if your child is having a social problem, it may be not appropriate for them to handle it themselves. I think that you know, some people, this is another piece that I think tends to get dichotomized. You know, parents either are over-involved and want to solve, you know, be the parent that might want to, you know, kind of jump in and really help their child, you know, call the teacher, solve the problem, take care of it. Or they might come down on the side of kids need to solve it themselves. And I think there is an art to learning what a child can solve themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, can they come up with a reasonable solution that would be appropriate to a social conflict? And if they can, then they're ready to handle it. If they're, for example, involved in some sort of ongoing exclusionary dynamic where every day they go to school and they get excluded and people are really mean to them and they feel like they don't have any friends, that might be too big of a social problem for kids to handle themselves. Mm-hmm. And adults need to step in, and it's our job to step in to influence children's peer culture at that point. So I would encourage parents to get involved in what's going on in their child's social life and to understand it.
One more thing, perhaps we have time for.
Let's see.
The blanket rule. I think that can we touch on that?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
I think that sometimes there have been many schools where they have decided that one way to solve exclusionary problems when they realize how common they are is to establish a blanket rule, like everyone can play, or you can't say you can't play. And I would suggest that that's not going to be effective, because what's going to happen is if you have a normative behavior, a behavior that's totally normal for kids, like exclusion, and you tell them not to do it, it's just going to go underground and they're going to keep doing it.
Hmm. You don't want that. Suzanne, I understand that you make yourself available by phone or in person as a consultant. If any teachers, parents are listening and want to talk with you further or actually perhaps consult with you, how can they get in touch with you?
I think the easiest way is to email me. My email address is my first initial and my last name. So S as in Sam, F as in Frank, A-N-G-E-R at utexas.edu. So that's S-F-A-N-G-E-R at utexas.edu. And I do work with both schools and families who are experiencing social issues with children and might need a little bit of guidance on how to best handle them.
So keep that name in mind, Dr. Suzanne Fanger. She is planning to write some books about this issue in the future. Thank you so much for joining us tonight and taking the time to come all the way up here from the Bay Area.
Thank you for having me.
Again, we've been speaking with Dr. Suzanne Fanger. She specializes in socio-emotional education to help parents and educators solve peer issues among young children. Her most recent research is on Understanding the Excluder, Why Young Children Exclude Their Peers. Thank you for listening to Bread and Roses tonight. I'm Leanne Kranz, and we're going to go out with a song by Liz Phair, Whip Smart.
And I'm gonna tell my Mellow Mood Fridays, a live reggae music series, March 28th, April 4th, and 11th. Featuring artists Synergy, Adrian Xavier, The Rising Buffalo Tribe, Positive Vibes, Papawastic, Jesse Jenda, Archangel, and the African Foundation Crew. Roots, Reggae, and Dancehall. Jamaican, African, regional, and island vibes, dancing, and positive community times. For more information, visit hawthornetheater.com. Sponsored by Mellow Mood Pipe, Mike Thrasher presents KBOO Community Radio, Just Some Reggae Folk, and EMET events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the JHS Annual Multicultural Film Festival's presentation of Two Americans. This documentary considers the status of undocumented immigrants in light of Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio's civil rights violations. This showing of Two Americans will be facilitated by Mr. Freddy Trujillo, who will lead the discussion following the movie. Two Americans will be shown at the North Portland Neighborhood Library at 512 North Killingsworth on Tuesday, April 8th, starting at 6 p.m. More information on this event can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is M1 from Dead Prez.
Hey, what's up? This is Boots from the Coup.
Nah, I mean, telling you to stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Keep it locked.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten-ass system.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one. News, views, and hip-hop.
Peace and love. This is Azeem. You're listening to Hard Knock Radio. Real radio. From the concrete up. All the way to the sun. Keep shining, y'all. One love.
What's up, folks? This is your girl Femi representing the whole Bay Area. I'm here on Hard Knock Radio. News, views, and hip-hop. Stay tuned.
Davey D hanging out with you, Hard Knock Radio. Yesterday, the Supreme Court extended what many people consider the most egregious and most repressive law in politics. It is one that allows corporations to be on the same playing field as individuals. In other words, a corporation has the right to voice themselves without restraint. It has the right to insert itself financially into a political fight. And now the Supreme Court just ruled that all the caps that have been placed on individuals, including corporations, are now removed. That means that a big corporation can handpick a candidate and totally finance their campaign 100% without any sort of limitations. Some of us call it the privatization of politics. And so, first of all, joining us on the line is somebody who follows these things. She's a media justice advocate, a political guru. She's also a professor down in Southern California, Tina Wright of the Hip Hop Congress. But Tina, I wanted to start this conversation with you. I would imagine that while many of us, including myself, are shocked and disappointed, this move by the Supreme Court is something that you have not only been anticipating, but, are not surprised in the least.
Hi, Davey. Thanks for having me. And you're absolutely right. I'm not surprised in the least. You know, I've been writing and we've been talking about this push towards privatization as a way to kind of consolidate power in a country with changing demographics. So I believe that we're, you know, seeing basically the onset of not just, you know, privatization of politics where basically one person, one vote is going to mean nothing. We see it with education. We see it, obviously, with, the fact that, well, people won't be able to have jobs, but at least we'll be able to put them in our private prisons and free labor that way. So this is all basically a way that privatization is working to keep power and resources in the hands of very few in a quickly changing and more accessible society. And so far, you know, like we've been talking about, you know, there are people organizing against it, but just not effective enough yet. And so far, it's definitely been working. And this latest Supreme Court regressive law upheld is going to just kind of be another nail in the coffin.
We've talked about this, and the word privatization is something used a lot. We just talked about this in terms of real estate just a couple of days ago on this show. With that being said, do you get the sense, and especially as a professor who teaches this, that people are getting it? Do your students get it? Do they understand it? Or are these still just words that, you know, like, yeah, intellectually I hear what you're saying, but business as usual, either because they have a false hope or they feel overwhelmed that there's nothing they could do about it?
It's a good question, and I think that a lot of people do get it, but I think that people live in the here and now, and it's very, very difficult for them to, you know, try to plan, strategize, and organize for the better tomorrow. So, for example, let me just give you an example of my school. You know, I teach sociology at Southwest College in L.A., and, you know, this is a school that serves, you know, areas of South L.A., very poor, working class, Black, brown, and a lot of students there, because of budget cuts and whatever, are being pushed out of,